Our journey is at its end. We've finally reached part four of our discussion of Duel of the Fates. Is it actually the end? We'll find out by the time this thing's recorded. But we will talk about the epic Act 3 of Duel of the Fates, Episode 9, the script by Derek Connolly and Colin Trevorrow. In this episode, we're going to get in to where the characters all go, what happens to them, and how this story comes to its conclusion. And maybe, just maybe, we'll get into another part of this pod, create something else. That's all coming up on the Droids.
I forgot.
Welcome back to the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Alongside Chris, Ryan, and Sam, I am Mike, and back for part four of our discussion of Duel of the Fates, the script by Colin Trevorrow, Derek Connolly. Get into all of that, but we have a little bit of housekeeping before we get that, but we're moving fast because we know we have a lot to cover, and we've talked about doing this podcast for several weeks now. We're finally here in part four.
It's now 5 a.m.
Will it be part four, or will we be getting beyond that? We don't know. We start this without any end point in mind. So we're hoping we get through all of Act 3, but we'll see how it goes. There's so much to talk about with this script. It's so much fun. But do not forget, this Saturday, April 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern, live.droidspod.com. Chris, did I get it right?
You got it right. That's it.
We are going live with Episode 4, Star Wars, A New Hope, whatever you want to call it. We will be live on Facebook, live.droidspod.com. You can watch us, join the conversation, let us know what you think of our whole discussion. We want to have you be a part of this whole thing. So sync up the movie, watch it with us, and have a great time with your droids on a Saturday night.
I can't think of a better way to spend your Saturday night than with four beautiful strangers talking about the thing they love.
And since,
or with four strangers,
considering considering
talking
the current
about the thing
three beautiful strangers and one other stranger,
considering the current situation in terms of social distancing and quarantining, I mean your options are so depleted that why not
if you find yourself literally staring at a wall. This is better than staring at a wall.
Look, you're out of episodes of Friends. You've already been through all of Bake Off, okay? You've seen The West Wing 3 times, all right? Now, and where do they stream the Sandpiper Airlines?
Oh, that's on Hulu.
That's on Hulu. Okay, so maybe you maybe don't have a Hulu account, right? So maybe you
yeah,
because
if
Wings.
They do, we're toast.
Because you don't
if
want
they have a Hulu account, they can watch Wings. We're toast.
We're done.
This
we
is
can't
what
compete
saying.
With that.
I know.
We can't
I know.
Compete
our,
with
guys, I know our audience. All right, and they are flyers. Okay, and so they want to. I know what they're watching. And if you can't watch Wings because you don't have a Hulu account, tune in live.droidspod.com. Right.
We got
bon
it.
Appetit.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. live.droidspod.com. Get in there. We're going to be flying all over the galaxy out to Alderaan. We'll see if it's still there this time. We'll talk all about it. It'll be fun.
It's going to be great. We'll have the time code up on the
screen.
The screen, there it is. And
I don't know how long
you
we're
could follow along, you could sync there. If you're like in the ballpark of the time, we'll be doing it on Disney Plus. Is that true?
Yes.
We're going to be watching the McClunky cut. So
how has it not been called that by now? I
don't know. Yeah, you have
McClunky cut. Chris, you said that we're all strangers here. I think if you're a longtime listener of the Droids, you're not a stranger. You might as well just be family.
Wow, there it is. Official tip of the cat to all our listeners.
All Mike our has family. Adopted all of you.
it's the Pod Live Garden.
Pod Live
when
Garden.
When you're near your family.
There it
exactly.
is. Exactly. The Pod Live Garden.
All right, other things going on in the Droids world. We want to get right into part four, but we do have to mention, leave those reviews on iTunes. You will get a chance at the beautiful, again, beautiful, not stranger, not strange, it's beautiful artwork from Sam. An art custom piece that he will make for you as we choose from those reviews. So leave those for us. Sam, anything else that people need to know about these beautiful works of art you're creating?
They're watercolor. They're going to be roughly like 4 inches by 6 inches or 5 by 5, somewhere in that. They're a small piece, but it's going to be completely custom.
Average
you can
piece.
Name the,
they're an average piece.
You can name the, you know, you can name the scene, character, ship, whatever you want. I'll paint it. You can see some examples on our Instagram at DroidsPod. But yeah, every one, or we'll pick one out of every 10 reviews we get.
Hey Sam, if I leave a review, am I eligible?
No. I'm going to say I know for a fact you already have
it. We'll circle back on that.
Because I wanted to think, what is the most awkward frame of Star Wars that's ever been made? Because I want you to paint that.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Well, I'm glad.
There's
okay.
quite a few.
That's a great question.
There's an incentive for you guys out there to leave some reviews. You got 10, 11 movies of
and
all Star Wars
from
Luke
Attack
kissing.
Of the Clones.
I want Leia and Luke kissing in Empire. But I want you to change Harrison's face so that it's kind of like he like walked in like, whoa, like a French forest. And I want you to make it more graphic.
He just got the news. He knows what's up.
Yeah. See, this is not
he's
just
like opening a door.
Not just straight from the film. You can interpret it how you would like, and Sam will follow that.
To an extent.
It's going to, yeah, there's.
We don't want to get Sam on any watch lists.
Any more watch lists.
Yeah, he's not going to show you the scene after Anakin arrives with the younglings. He's not going to show you how that actually played
Sam,
out.
Sam, that's
what I want.
Good
luck flying to Canada after that. Huh?
All right, we'll say from a screen or photo reference.
Would you make one of Anakin killing younglings? Excuse me, killing youngling.
I'd have to think about it. That'd be hard for me. Emotionally.
I mean, like, as graphic as possible is what we're asking.
Everybody talked at once. What?
As graphic as possible is what we'd be asking.
It's Sam, all I want now. It's really all I want.
Let's wrap I'll it up there on that. Let's just say, you know, make sure you leave those reviews and get a chance. We're making jokes, but really we've talked about it in previous podcasts. Sam, we all have a Sam, a custom Sam, and it is one of the things we cherish most. So.
The way we're asking for these reviews is like we're in some kind of Breaking Bad type situation where we need the reviews.
We are.
We do.
Uh-oh. You guys made that deal?
Well, all right. So the only other piece of news before we get into this is that there is going to be an 8-part documentary on The Mandalorian that's launching on Disney Plus on May 4th when The Clone Wars ends, same day. So for those of you who are caught up, enjoy the conclusion of The Clone Wars. But also, 8 parts. There were only 8 episodes of The Mandalorian. They are going to do a documentary per episode, or not documentary, per episode, and that's going to play out. I believe they're doing it. I don't know if they're doing it week by week or all at once, but that'll be fun, and, you know, good old Favreau is back to his dinner for 5 days, and he's going to do roundtable discussions with the people who made the show. So some light within these dark times as we get to relive our Dinner for Five love.
I did love Dinner for Five.
Yeah,
I hope David Milch is on this episode. And Michael
what do we think the runtime is going to be of each of these?
Three to six minutes.
I'll give it 20 minutes.
That feels right.
For Favreau to talk about all of the technology that he invented for this.
Well, think about it. They probably had like an hour planned documentary, and they took that and now cut it up into 8 episodes. So maybe they took some cutting room floor footage to get a few more episodes in there.
Hey, in your reviews for the paintings, also say what color you think Dave Filoni's cowboy hat will be.
That's how we'll know.
How many times can we should make it like a drinking game where you can say, like, anytime he says George's vision, you can drink to that.
Anytime someone says practical.
All right, let's get to part 4 of episode 9, bum, 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 Duel of the Fates. Bum, bum, bum,
bum, bum. You know what? Actually, I have to take off. Maybe we should push it.
Yeah, well, okay.
You know what? I agree.
You guys texted about this separately.
Yep. I have to go a little return a book boy. To the library. I don't read.
Probably not the place you want to be right now, Chris.
No.
Let's recap where we are. So, as we begin Act 3 of this script, Finn and Rose have completed their mission to send out a message using the Old Republic system in the Jedi Temple, but Kylo has thwarted it by using his new power to end the transmission from afar and destroy the temple. Finn and Rose thrown asunder, Rose falls deep into a dark cavern as they were leaving on the zipline. Well, we don't know if she survived. Finn surrounded by stormtroopers and in desperate peril. Poe and Chewie are headed back to join the Resistance after Rey uses the Jedi mind trick to send Poe away in what is widely regarded as the most devastatingly beautiful moment of the sequel trilogy. Anyone who thinks otherwise has been dismissed from existence.
Oh my gosh.
Ooh, wow.
Rey and Kylo are both headed to Mortis, Kylo to seek out the power there and Rey to stop him. Rey has just seen the darkness in herself when she uses dark side lightning to take out Hisaka Ren, whose mask reminds her of the day her parents left her. Kylo has learned the power to take the living force from others by thanks to Tor Valum, who he also took the living force from, and he's ready to gain the last bit of power to give him the ultimate power in the universe, all from Mortis. So, that's where our characters are left to be. I don't think we need to talk about our expectations here for Act 3. Let's just kind of get into it. And beginning with where we start things off is, I think, what sets up a really interesting moment for Finn and his Stormtrooper arc as he is, as he finds a Stormtrooper, I believe he kind of escapes within the rubble of everything, finds another Stormtrooper, jumps him. This is RK-514. He tells him to take off his helmet and to remember his parents. You had a name once. Do you remember it? RK-514 shakes his head, says no. Get a name. That's the first step. Then what? Find something worth fighting for. Now, I think this is just, we can't call out every moment of what happens in the script going forward. We'll never get this thing done. We'll be on part 37. But I wanted to set that up because it's a really great payoff later on. So we can talk about that when we get to the payoff. But just some dialogue there that I think could be cheesy, but in the right hands could be done well. And again, this is still a working script. So set up. And then we have Rose with General Hux in what to me felt like a pretty classic Star Wars dialogue bit moment back and forth, where Hux is torturing Rose and says, while she's on the vertical torture rack, "Are you comfortable?" And she says, "Yeah, I have one of these at home." And then he asks for the codes, the Eclipse. She says, "You know, they told me to pick something easy to remember, like Life Day." And again, is that going to work? It's about the performance. But then my favorite part of this is that Hux tries to use the Force to torture Rose. And she says, "You're not special, not at all." And this through line of Hux trying desperately to get the Force. We've talked about it before, master it. And then it kind of pays off really well at the end here. But that's kind of a nice little start here of Act 3 as we see both Finn and Rose taking their next steps on their story journey.
I love that they even do this in Rise of Skywalker, but it's like the progression of Hux becoming more of a buffoon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he was never, in the first one, he's kind of a threat, but I think they're playing off of like Donald Gleason's strengths.
Yep.
Which is that he can kind of ride that line of sinister and buffoonish. And I think that I like that they're continuing on. Also, like, the moments that Rose gets in, we've spoken about this before, the moments that Rose gets in this script are so much better than the no moments that she got in Rise of Skywalker.
And the pat on the back from Finn.
The just on the Hux kind of buffoonery note, like, it's the kind of perfect thing to do with a Hitler analog or like a dictatorial analog for in a film. You know, it's what Mel Brooks did in The Producers. You know, it's like the only kind of way is to like to truly take away their power is to like not make those figures fearsome, but like make them just like clowns, make them idiots. Right. And so the fact that he doesn't quite start at like a full 10 on the comedy scale in the first movie makes it all the more rewarding to be like, look at how these people end up. You know, it's really well done. And I think Donald Gleason would have crushed it. Like he can be so funny.
I think it's nice that you planted your flag here for Jojo Rabbit, Sam. I respect that. And I'm glad that you're coming down on that side of the Jojo Rabbit argument.
Well, that is where I come down on that argument. I have not seen that movie yet. I have not seen that movie yet. So I don't know. That's not a hidden message, please.
Well, and I do want to say, I've said it in the previous editions of this podcast, but I again, Hux, it is all the funnier that, you know, the Force is available to anybody and he just wants to be evil and he can't access it. I kind of feel bad for the guy, but I like the buffoon aspect as you're talking about. I guess, you know, just maybe I'm a Russian troll and I want to see Hux win.
Ryan, I want to know if in describing the where we opened with Finn, did that remind you of any movie that I know you and I have seen multiple times and love to hate watch?
With Finn?
With Finn and the stormtrooper.
Is it the Martha?
No. It reminded me, though, of the Justice League, the Batman Flash moment of just save one. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, how do I start type thing.
Yeah. Oh. That was a good modulated voice impression.
Thank you. Thank you. I have, honestly, quarantine, I've had just a lot of time with my impressions.
With your dialect coach.
With my bat fleck, you know, with my Release the Snyder Cut stands that I hang out with online in the community. No, I actually think all the lines, I mean, look, we've talked about it a number of times before on this script that it's like the lines themselves would probably get an additional layer of polish. But also I think there is the magic of this cast, like the cast of the original trilogy, like much of the cast of the prequel trilogy. Like, they cast well. They have people who can take lines that look like this on the page, you know, that look like they told me to choose something simple like Life Day that, like, maybe reads as a little flat or a little clunky, and it's like they're going to sell it. The charisma, the music, the light, you know, everything's going to work together,
also,
and it's going to crush.
Here's the big secret of, like, big Hollywood movies. Most of the scripts, the dialogue reads flat. Mm. Like, most movies that you love, if you read the script, you'd be like, this sounds cheesy.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean,
that's why it's hard to read scripts. Yeah. It's
the
like
dialogue.
It seems bad.
Dialogue popped for me, this whole script. I loved every bit of it. And maybe my imagination just wanted to love all
of
it.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, it's just all how people paint the picture, right? I think the script is just only one part of the movie.
And you
it's
know what?
The sum of the whole.
My brain is painting a Sam masterpiece when I read this.
There
script.
It is.
Trying to give you a tip of the cat there, Sam.
I appreciate it. I love it. I'll paint this whole movie.
Do we want to cut back and forth between Mortis and the battle on Coruscant, or do we want to just like focus on one of those and go forward? I'm opening this up to the group.
I say we go as the script goes.
Yeah, okay. So in this, we also find Lando. Leia has made a trip to seek out Lando as he owns a cabaret club. This kind of felt like a little bit of a weak spot. It's just more of let's introduce Lando so we can pay him off later when he does have his moment, very similar to The Rise of Skywalker, where he comes to the battle at the end, bringing with him a bunch of smugglers. But I didn't feel a whole lot in here, as it just was kind of like Han told me to protect you, but this is too big a fight for me, so I'm not joining. And then she just kind of gets back on her shuttle and leaves.
I will say that at least like a club owner who like, I don't know. That it's a better. It feels like a better fit and a better intro than what they did in Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah,
it's also implying this is going off The Last Jedi thing too with Luke that I know pissed so many people off. But it's implying that like Lando at the end of Return of the Jedi that everybody wasn't just like fixed.
Yeah,
you know, like it's like in Rise of Skywalker, Lando, like at the end of Jedi, becomes like the good guy, one of the good guys, and so continues on that way, and like everybody stays cemented as they were. But in this, it's like, you know, the rebellion ended; things were okay for a little bit before the First Order took hold, and so he like went back to what he knew how to do, which is like smuggling and kind of being a
It's like not
an underbelly guy, but you know, he's like he rides that line,
right? And it's like it's also kind of just that theme of Star Wars of just like sad dads like Han Solo. He was like he's like drifted around with Chewie and the Falcon now, and then like Lando's story is like these guys were once heroes, but they can't live in those glory days their whole lives. Like at a certain point they'd be like, what do you do exactly?
Also, like, there's nothing interesting about people who are like just heroes. That's why everybody likes Han so much.
Well, you know, I didn't mean to cut you off, there's also this thing about, you know, the people, you know, there's something I've been thinking about recently with actually like what's going on in the real world right now. And like that we're all under this quarantine and there's, you know, a lot of sort of misinformation, like fear around this virus that we all have to be very careful and cautious of. But like there are people who are good in a crisis. Like there are people who are good when things are bad. And
thank you,
they're
Sam.
Not always who you expect, you know, like Chris's calm stability has shocked me, quite frankly. But like this idea that like, you know, Han Solo and Lando Calrissian and some of these rebellion heroes who may have, to varying degrees, you know, sold out or been kind of crummy figures in life before the wars, and you know, rose up to when they were needed and when the time was right. Like, it's no guarantee that that then becomes their life. Like, there's something interesting about that to me too, you know, that it's like there, you know, people can be kind of built for a time and place. This is a weird tangent. I love this conversation.
Well, he says, Lando says, the clientele are mostly first order, but what can I do? It's like, yeah, it's, he's in the same dilemma he was in the first time. It's like he'd prefer not to deal with the Empire, but...
Boy, I... You know, yeah. I brushed off this scene a little too much. He is an opportunist.
Huh? Yeah.
Say that again, Mike.
I brushed off this scene a little bit. You guys show me there's a lot more to it than I took away.
Well, it's a high-level approach that they took, you know, that's different than the Rise of Skywalker was.
Mike, would you say there's Mortis meets the eye?
Speaking of Mortis, within there, we get back to Mortis. And when we've been talking about this script in the past, I had not watched the Clone Wars episodes about Mortis. Now that I have, and I've revisited the script again, I love the description is essentially the same as what we saw in the Clone Wars. The changing seasons, the, you know, moments where it turns like to lightning and fire, and how parts of the planet you can clearly see are so different from each other. I like that we get the description of what they see when they arrive on the planet. We then get more from there. But Sam, I know you love Mortis, and just this being the setting for this to all take place feels so well entwined with what we've been experiencing through Star Wars for the last, you know, four decades, but really the last like 10 years with Clone Wars. And it's great that they would connect it all. It's almost like they had a plan. It's almost like they had something in mind they wanted to say rather than randomly making things up on the day they shot.
Or if it was like, if there was like, I don't even know what you'd call it, but like a group that was like responsible for like story... That was weighing in to make sure things were consistent. Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think we were all, I think those Mortis episodes on Clone Wars were one of the moments, much like, I think, the entirety of The Last Jedi, like the entirety of Empire or like Phantom Menace, where you have this like big leap in Star Wars lore. You know, you have this big leap in like what the world and the world building is. And it was really exciting to get there on the Clone Wars series. And I can only imagine, because that was new for me within the last, you know, 3 months that I kind of reached that point in the series. Cause I'm, you know, look, listeners, you know, we're way behind on this. You know, we kind of slept on Clone Wars for a while. But like that was so exciting. And the idea that so many people wouldn't have seen it. And yeah, I don't know what the response would have been. I don't know if audiences would have, you know, been frustrated to see something new, something that wasn't what they expected or thought they wanted. But again, there's
This isn't going to go how they think, and they're going to be upset, Sam.
What's so frustrating
people are very
about
Skywalker?
They, you know, what they seem to have done with the Rise of Skywalker was like, you know, sell out for the short term satisfaction at the expense of the long-term story. You know, this thing would have, I think, over time, this film, which there's stuff we're going to get to in this part that I don't love, and we already talked about, I don't love the, like, romantic, you know, Poe and Rey angle that they kind of teased.
Stop hating on my ship.
For me. But it's like...
No room for on that ship.
Whatever form this film would have taken, I think, you know, in the 10, 20, 30, 50 years down the road, you know, it would have served the story better than, I think, you know, I think in 20 years or 30 years, you know, when whatever it is, when like the next generation of people is discovering Star Wars, I mean, I think it's going to be, people are really going to scratch their head and they're going to be like, I can't believe they ended with this garbage film of Episode 9.
Well, what Episode 9 as it exists kind of ends up doing, and like, I'm not saying it undoes the joy of The Last Jedi, but in terms of canon, what it kind of ends up doing is just kind of nullifying the sequel trilogy. Yeah. Like, it kind of just returns everything to the status quo that it was before, and it's like, okay, Like, it's like it didn't happen. There was actually no, like, growth in the quote-unquote galaxy.
It completely neuters everything they did.
I should say it neutralizes it, where it's like everything that changed is unchanged, and now it's back to exactly how it was. So it puts it in this strange place, because they can't do anything now except kind of just be like, we're starting anew, because...
I don't know if that's fair to Claude.
Well, I think, Sam, you bring up a good point. I think people would be excited to see a new setting, and if you weren't familiar with Mortis, it's a cool enough planet, and you know they would, you know, do it in a way that
visually
be awesome.
it falls in the themes of Star Wars, of each planet kind of having their own thing, and it's also cool that Mortis is like all of the seasons, because you usually have like a desert planet, an ice planet, a green planet, and now it's like, oh, this planet is everything and nothing,
as opposed to Exegol, which was just nothing.
Which was just like,
you know, how like every planet has its thing, and Exegol's was dark blue.
Yeah, Exegol's was like big clouds off in the distance
and lightning with chalkboard scratches as the lightning came in. That's basically
not
that's like someone
Jedi.
Saying the theme of this movie is revenge. It's like, that's like, that's not a whole theme of a movie.
We go back to Finn, and he crosses path finally with Dade, who we met earlier in the story, who's one of the people who've been living kind of underground within Coruscant. Dade introduces him to the 10,000 so citizens ready to fight back. It's a bit of a convenience that they find an army just waiting for them, but you know, I don't hate on it. It's been done.
I call him Daddy, by the way. Sorry, it's D-A-D-E. I think it's
really
Daddy.
Confusing in the script if Finn was referring to another character as Daddy. You're like, wait a second.
Sam doesn't know how to spell. I like the army thing because the story that they tell very quickly is that people have been ready to fight for a long time.
Yeah.
They've just been waiting for the opportunity.
I thought the musical number where they're like, do you hear the people sing? I thought it was a little on the nose, but I kind of liked it. It tied into our world.
It's a little bit Demolition Man. It's a little
Dennis
Leary.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Like,
it is.
Underground people, barrel fire. Like,
but I
think you know there's a barrel fire or
a
barrel energy beam or something.
I think in the bucket of sci-fi tropes, so having an underground population that has been like oppressed by a technological government, I think that is ripe for the picking.
Sure. I mean, it's Zion, it's the cops in Dark Knight Rises to an extent. I wouldn't call that an underground
society. It's how
society,
it's kind of how the audience is like, gets a little bit of a sigh of relief. They're like, oh, I do exist in this world now. Like,
yeah, I'd be one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be one of those people with the ratty beanie on, you know,
exactly.
Like, whatever.
Eating some kind of meat from a stick.
You guys
apparently
didn't
that's all they do.
You guys didn't relate to the patrons at the Taco Bell and Demolition Man, because that's who I thought I was.
I related to the shells.
Still haven't figured out the seashells.
I always look at the costuming of these, like, you know, Matrix or Demolition Man or like dystopian, you know, Escape from New York movies, and I'm like, I want that homemade cable knit sweater, but before it got all holy.
Yeah. What are they doing? They can't make
comfy.
They can't make clothes down there. They can grill everything on a stick, but they can't make clothes.
Where do I get a poncho made out of hay?
is this part? Sorry, did we talk about? Is this before? This is after the like sewer journey where he
Sam. I can't. You know, we only have 82 hours in this whole breakdown of the script. I can't mention every part.
Contractually, we are limited the number of episodes.
This is an uncharacteristically, as described in the script, it is an uncharacteristically like gross moment, I think, in Star Wars when Finn ends up in the sewer and there's like womp rats and then a Gyrock or Gryok or whatever, and it is described. Trevorrow and Connolly describe it in just such gnarly it feels like a James Cameron or Ridley Scott creation or something.
Feed on the refuse encased in the gelatinous mass. That's quite
a gelatinous mass is great.
So
that was my
anyway
in high school.
We see like there's kind of a jump scare like horror moment from which Data or Daddy, some people say it, you know, both ways, saves Finn and brings him to this city, and it's a great scene. And I think like this again, this continues the development. We saw Finn, it plants the seeds when he when he steps up with this one stormtrooper and encourages, you know, he steps into a bit of a leadership role. And then here, he goes full leader. It's really cool.
Well, and so, and speaking of that, this felt very, to me, Captain America Winter Soldier-esque. Not necessarily stepping into a leadership role he hadn't had before, but the way that Finn addresses everyone. And, you know, if you think of that scene and just Chris Evans' performance, I'm thinking like that hopefully John Boyega could pull off something similar.
When he's on the intercom, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Winter Soldier?
Yeah, exactly. And in this, Finn takes on the comm system, and he says, "My name is Finn. I bring a message from the Resistance. The First Order rules by fear. They build ships to intimidate us, wear masks to frighten us, but they're the ones who are scared. This is not the time to hide underground. If we take the capital, the galaxy will join us. Together we can strike back. Together we can resist." And I clearly, as you can tell, I'm not a performer, but I feel like
I just got chills, though, Mike. I got chills.
I did too. Yeah, I think I love it. I love when everyone starts chanting Rufio after that. It says the old woman grabs her spoon, so she's like the wisdom of the underground dwellers, and she starts rapping on the side of her wooden glass or whatever they're drinking out of, and then I love that it has the detail of cutting from alien to alien, which I think is just something Star Wars does very well. You're like, hey, that guy's cool. I wonder what his story is.
Star Wars cuts from alien to alien very well. I agree. I agree with that.
I think we could have had some nice Easter eggs in there, too. Like some characters from smaller bits of canon that would have popped up who maybe been...
Claude.
Well,
is it here
Dex
or later that they reference Six Eyes? Is it...
Oh, like, yeah.
But, like, that's a good, like, clearly, yeah. Like, you see the even in this early draft of the script, you see the like, moments where they're like, this is a great moment to drop in exactly what you're talking about, Mike. Like, one of those, like, not... It's not even quite a cameo. It's just, like, it's just an appearance of something that you've seen before.
They do it in Rogue One really well, too. You see similar aliens.
Well, and even in Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Yes.
At the Sabacc table. I think there's... Exactly. Isn't there a six-eyed at the Sabacc table, I feel like?
I think you're right.
Well, we go back to Mortis, and while we're at Mortis, I think we get what starts to be some of the, well, callbacks to other Star Wars, but just really this conclusion that is wonderfully thought out. And to start on Mortis, and even if you didn't know anything about Mortis because you were not familiar with the Clone Wars, to see Rey and Kylo arrive on the planet and immediately be flashed back into some of their past, which obviously is relevant for the story. It is a good storytelling tool, but it feels right for Star Wars that to be in a place that is strong with the Force, that they might have visions connected to what their past, present, and future could be. So Rey is brought back to her time on Jakku, brought back to that moment when her mother and father leave her. She's doing the comeback, wait. She's there, and you can see her mother trying to keep her safe. She says to Luke, as she's asking for Luke, "They were afraid. Why were they afraid?" And Luke doesn't answer, and her anger and fury only builds from there.
I love how contentious she is with Luke in this.
Yeah.
It's so good. Yeah.
It's
so good.
So good and interesting, and it like forces us as an audience to like rethink him. I know that people don't want to rethink him, but like to me it's fascinating.
I mean, it's also it's a Garden of Gethsemane moment, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like it's the why have you forsaken me? It's like, what am I meant to, like, you know? It's that feeling of when
why me?
When you're truly all alone, and it's like we've seen her find Luke, we've seen her draw him out to actually help her, we've seen him give at this point, you know, his greatest sacrifice and the greatest display of Jedi power that we've ever seen in any Star Wars, in the coolest moment ever, the best thing that ever happened, and people are conflicted about it for some stupid reason. And then he's like with her throughout this movie, and like you say, Ryan, this combative, like,
yeah,
more like it's not an arrogance, it's just like it's frustration, and it's like it's the minds not meeting, it's the young energy frustrated with, you know, older wisdom and viewpoints.
Yeah.
Much similar to a young...
So good.
It's very similar to like a young Luke who like thinks they know the answer or just wants the fast answer. But there is like, ultimately Luke had to figure it out and ultimately Rey has to figure it out.
Also, by the way, from a storytelling standpoint, if you want at the end for the audience to be relieved that their protagonist is not alone and have an emotional catharsis in realizing that they're not alone, we need to believe that they were alone.
Right. Yeah.
And then after that is one of the coolest scenes in this script.
Well, we get
to me. The flashback with Kylo.
We get Kylo as a younger version of himself. I'll let you.
I'd love to see that CGI, baby.
Ryan, I'll let you kind of jump in a little bit more, but I want to say that like this is kind of a house in the woods. We just kind of get the sense that this is where Leia and Han have settled down, and this is the first time that Kylo has returned in his. Well, Ben has become Kylo. Even in the script, he's still called as Ben instead of Kylo, and Han doesn't want Leia to see him. You know, his mother can't see him this way.
That's one of my favorite lines in the script, by the way.
Yeah, and your mother can't see you here, not like that.
Well, it's so in terms of what we've been talking about, and not deconstructing our heroes for like a meta sense, but in terms of continuing on with the people that they are despite small changes they've undergone. This is a very weak moment for Han. He's not receiving his son with like full love and acceptance,
yeah.
And like saying like, "Listen, we just want you home." He's saying like, "You need to leave. Your mother can't see you this way." And it's implying that like it adds so much more weight to the interaction he has with Kylo at the end of The Force Awakens, because it's acknowledging that Han knows that he made massive mistakes. This is probably a moment that not only haunts Kylo but has haunted Han, obviously, until his death. So it's like it's explaining why Han may be so filled with regret, as opposed to just rage at Snoke or having this feeling that he has with Leia in that scene, The Force Awakens, where he's like, he's gone. It's like Han isn't the spiritual person like Leia. He's not like a big picture guy. He just sees like, you're here, you're not who we want you to be, and so I need you to go because it'll upset your mother.
Right.
It's this, like, very weak... It's an upsetting thing for Han to do.
I think it strengthens what's set up in The Force Awakens upon their, like, reunion. It's like you get to see, like, oh, there's more weight than we know behind their reunion in The Force Awakens.
Also, think about... I mean, I think it adds, if even possible, because Adam Driver's so good, more emotional depth to Kylo. Could you... Like, maybe he was going and, like, deep down inside, he was thinking, like, all I need is for them to, like, talk me out of this.
He's doing this for the reaction. He's almost the way you would at 17.
Yeah, he shows up like a rebellious teenager.
Yeah.
It builds that feeling that I think really good movies have, that is when you're watching it, no matter how many times you've seen it, you do not want to believe the thing that happens. So, like, Star Wars has that for me a lot, where it's like, Luke's not, or Han Solo's not going to get frozen, or like Darth Vader's not going to do that. And then you, like, you think it in your head, and you, like, know it's not going to happen. And then it happens, and that's what makes the movie so exciting. That kind of scene with Kylo, it's like, oh my gosh, if they just made one small change in his life or something like that, he wouldn't have become Kylo Ren.
And yeah. In a good film, watching a character make the wrong choice is like one of the most inherently dramatic and compelling things that you can experience. And if you think about who would be in that scene, if you think that it's Adam Driver, and let's think about like Harrison Ford now playing that scene, and then they would obviously do some digital, you know, de-aging.
It would be,
I'm sure.
It'd be a Solo guy.
But Alden?
Oh my god, if it was Alden.
I don't think they'd have to do that much de-aging. It's only supposed to be like 10 years earlier. He's like an old guy.
Right. Well, I'm just saying they would do something. But
decrease the crags in his face.
Harrison Ford has, you know, he's doing a little bit, I feel like, of the Bill Murray thing of like doing less the older he gets and it's better. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Where it's like if you watch Blade Runner 2049, where, you know, it surprised me. Like, I didn't remember that Harrison Ford could be that good. I knew he could be that charismatic, but I didn't remember he could be that good.
He's
and it's
aged
like,
in such a way, like Bill Murray, where, like, his face is the story.
Yeah, 100%.
Clearly, but none of you saw Jackie Robinson, where he played Branch Rickey. I mean, Harrison crushed that performance.
Or that movie where he is working around the clock.
One of the
but
morning
glory. Think it's also, it's this... wonderful comment about like the kind of typical like emotional deficiencies of like men and sons, you know, and like of the generation that Han Solo like comes from in terms of our real world. you know, like how men were perceived then. And they're sitting there in this like traumatic moment, and all they're doing is talking about how the mother feels about this. And like Han is incapable of talking about how he feels about it. Like, you know, Ben is blaming Leia for sending him away, and Han saying like she wanted you to learn, but Han is acting like he had no agency in it. He's like behaving like kind of a father who sits in the chair and is like, oh, whatever your mother wants, you know. And like that reaps its own emotional damage. And he says like, your mother loves you, like that's his comfort to him. He doesn't say anything about how he feels.
Well, but he does say, and it's the callback to the line that Leia has at the end of The Last Jedi. He does say, you have everything you need right here. And I think, Ryan, the way the scene is read is spot on. I think there's a little bit of credit in there of like the reluctant father showing love.
Of course. Yeah. And what I'm saying is I don't think that Han has, the way he's drawn in the scene, he doesn't have the emotional capability.
Yeah.
It's like that's his deficiency, is that he literally doesn't even know how to express it.
And it's how your son reads that. It's how a 17-year-old reacts to that, because a 17-year-old can't emotionally understand everything that their father probably does want but can't say. And I think that makes it even more
powerful.
Sure,
and nor should it fall on him to do so.
No.
You know, it
also, I mean, you mentioned the line, you have everything you need right here. And the writing on this is very good, because it also ties back then to Force Awakens, where he's like, give me your lightsaber. So it's like there is it kind of is tying that whole little story of like there's like three lines basically that you could sum up their relationship with, and they hit them all here.
And isn't it all the more powerful that it's not a memory that he's interacting with or not interacting with that makes you sort of believe that it's a Force ghost, but it's not a Force ghost, where this is an actual thing that happened between the characters?
Yeah. It's a memory. Yes. I think in Star Wars, I always struggle with kind of the flashbacks, like fourth wall time changes and shifts, just because originally they're kind of not paced that way. And I think that Star Wars is like a story that you're kind of watching in real time unfold, even though it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But I think they did it really well in this instance.
I also think like something that's interesting about this script is I think JJ, you know, we've talked about like what he was doing and what he was trying to do. And you know, Chris, I've kind of come around to think like maybe your read is correct, that it was just like he just straight up made the movie he wanted to see and he thought he wanted to see and he thought people would want to see that. But it's funny how many of the scenes that like are echoes of what Trevorrow was doing like just feel like weaker versions to me. Like the whole thing with like Finn and Janna as like the whole payoff for Finn's Stormtrooper rebellion is like less good than where this script goes with it. The scene between, you know, Adam Driver and Harrison Ford in Rise of Skywalker, that's a lot of people, that's their favorite scene. And, you know, I certainly think the two actors do a heck of a lot with that scene. But then you look at like, oh, this idea where it's a where it's a memory to a very painful and like fulcrum moment in you know, Kylo Ren, Ben Solo's life.
And new information.
It's like 100 times better.
Also, by the way, this scene that we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes is a page and a half long.
Yeah. It's just so dense. That's pretty wild. I think I kind of keep going back and thinking of like The Rise of Skywalker in the sense of like Spider-Man 3, where they were kind of like, well, we got to put this in there and we got to put this in there. And then what happens is you put so much into the movie that everyone only gets like a 6-minute segment, and then you can't really build off of anything there.
I think we really missed out on a Poe dance sequence, if you're asking me.
When Poe goes emo?
Yeah, I needed that.
You mean Epo? Oh,
did you just like correct yourself? just punched up your own bit.
You perfected it.
I'm a Force joke dyad.
All right, it is tough to move on from this scene because I think there's still even more we want to focus on.
And that'll do it for the droid you're looking for.
But I I'm very sad we didn't get this scene. I'm very sad it wasn't filmed. And there's so much in the script that I would have loved to see actually come through. You know, you think of a fulcrum point, as you say, Sam. What was that moment where someone said, we can't do this script? Can we go back there? Can we change that? You know, because there's a lot of things a lot of people would change in the last 4 years. But if there's anything I'm changing, it's just to get this script made. If I had time travel, I'm not stopping the 2016 election. I'm making this script happen.
I like it, Mike.
Well, look, yikes. I mean, look.
I even let JJ direct this script. I don't care.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. You know what? And it's Derek Connolly and Colin Trevorrow did get writing credits on The Rise of Skywalker because of probably, what, three different things in here where he took it and, like you said, Sam, made it a thing that was less than?
I'd say that was just the work of really good agents.
Yeah. You put well,
and Colin Trevorrow very classily donated all of his residuals to charity.
Yeah.
You know, we were really too hard on the guy. You know, I think when we heard he was directing 9, I was very negative, and I apologize.
Oh, I still don't think he's an interesting director at all. I just think that there's a much better script than what we got.
Well, yeah.
He is my best friend and the greatest director of all time.
I do wonder, I always get so curious about, like, when there's films at this level, anytime you can see a script, you know, I'm like, who wrote what? Like, I mean, it's the unanswerable question who wrote what. Like, I'm kind of curious, you know, did Trevorrow do, like, some broad strokes and then Connolly, like, wrote this thing and it's great? Or did they sit down together and write it? Or was one on dialogue, one on story? Or what, you know?
You mean the way that, like, JJ got a writing credit on the Lawrence Kasdan script for The Force Awakens?
I mean, I don't know how that happened or how much.
Just saying, we saw The Rise of Skywalker.
JJ is a director of a, you know, he's a director who can, like, command the, like, written and directed by, which is what he wants. And I think, you know, or I mean, I guess he doesn't do written and directed by, but he gets the writing and directing credit on his movies
only
at this point.
Written slash directed one movie, which is Super 8. That's the only thing where he has the sole, like, written and directed by credit.
Right. So I was correcting myself to say, like, it's not, like, it's not that literal credit. Right. It's the, but he wants writing credit on.
And what's he using?
I was double correcting you to let you know that I knew you were
wrong. Is he writing on a MacBook Air? Maybe one of those iPad keyboards?
Based on his TED Talk, he loves Macs.
There's a lot of Macs in Felicity. There's, like, parts of Felicity where it's just Mac commercials.
That they didn't even have to pay for because everyone just
colorful
uses it anyway.
iMacs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the old G3s. I think that I would be interested to see a documentary about them just writing Star Wars. There's some of that on the prequel documentaries with George Lucas, like how he's literally sitting at the computer writing it with his notebooks.
The last
can you imagine one of those like Breaking Bad podcast like style, like if they just did a breakdown for each movie with if you could get like
yes,
the actual creators, you know.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The Last Jedi would be Ryan in all these conversations with the story group, and then Rise of Skywalker would be JJ and Chris doing it on their own.
Well, according to the art of The Last Jedi, both kind of The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi were written in relative like bubbles, with the story group, but they were kind of like their own little side pockets because they didn't have any reactions to any of the movies except the originals yet. I wonder if they should have just written the third one in that same time period.
Well, they wrote the third one before The Last Jedi came out. So they essentially had the same experience that Ryan did, which is he had the script and whatever footage they had seen.
No, the difference is that the movies weren't released, so they didn't have like the reaction base yet.
Oh, you're saying because movie. Yeah.
What I'm saying is that... There had been no reaction to The Last Jedi yet.
No, but there was reaction to The Force Awakens. I think there was. Right. According to the book, there was. The book positions itself as saying The Last Jedi was unique in that fact.
But he did go back and do rewrites on The Last Jedi to include the newer characters more.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is I think that there's more of a purity to this script because is dated before The Last
script.
Jedi came out.
Yes.
So there was no reaction to that. They were reacting to the story and they thought was interesting.
Yeah.
The dual fate script. Sorry, I was mixing up with The Rise of Skywalker.
Because this was a year before The Last Jedi.
Oh, The Rise of Skywalker was written by like a Reddit thread.
All right, as we continue onward in a nice more bit of kind of callback, Finn commandeers an AT-MT. We don't know what that would look like, but we imagine it's similar to like an AT-AT or an AT-ST. We have to believe it is. So, oh, and
can we just go back to real quick to C-3PO has a great little bit.
Sure.
Where he's walking through Coruscant, like the slums, and he goes, "I agree, this isn't the Coruscant I remember."
Yeah, that's cool. I wonder how Anthony Daniels would have said he was dissatisfied with his part in this movie.
I love his part in this movie.
Yeah. Does he even remember Coruscant, though? Didn't he have his mind wiped before?
Oh.
Wait, where was his mind wiped?
His mind was wiped after episode 3.
That
wiped
is
the
true.
Protocol droid.
Oh, this is true.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it could stand to reason that they've been to Coruscant since then, because he has been with Leia and she's involved in the New Republic.
That's true.
But, yeah, I don't know. Ooh.
No, totes. I don't think that matters. I think it's completely believable that C-3PO would have been back to Coruscant and would have memories of a good Coruscant.
And that'll do it for the droid you're looking for. Wow.
Well, so we,
I thought that was a great line. I think it's funny to put C-3PO, like, he kind of lost a little bit of that in the sequel trilogy of him being kind of like this kind of like stuck up droid who like always lived around senators and kings.
I think it's like a nice callback, but I find it like strangely emotional.
Yeah.
Too, because it's saying, look at how the world has changed, and it's effortlessly wrapping us back into like, you remember also what Coruscant was like.
Yeah.
Well, it's also been that kind of discussion of class and social inequality that we saw when they came to Coruscant, and it continues because Rose mentions it, and then C-3PO mentions it. But I think this is the start of C-3PO having some really gut-wrenching moments in the third act. There's a lot more that I feel like I was welling up just by reading them as we get to it, not just thinking of what Anthony Daniels would do, but I felt it was really well conceived of the relationship between C-3PO and R2 and what happens as we move forward in the script. But we have Finn taking over commandeering this vehicle with the resistance fighters. We then find out that Rose has escaped. Hux is sending off the brute troopers, who are Mandalorian brute troopers. They're disappointed that the regular stormtroopers aren't doing the job, so they want these mercenaries. And these mercenaries are built up in the script as certainly a little bit more imposing, less likely to miss every shot that they take, and they're Mandalorians. So I wonder if there was part of, like, if they were doing this script, they would have said, okay, they can't be Mandalorians because we're doing a whole Mandalorian show.
It might tie in. Oh, that's true.
I don't know. It might have tied into what's Logan director and Walk the Line? What's his name?
James Mangold.
It might have tied into Mangold's Boba Fett movie.
Oh, yeah.
Possibility. I think for the, those kind
there
of
could
mom-
be Mandalorians that are less than honorable. You know, they have all the tools, but there's a story there
in Rebels and in Clone Wars. I think for these kind of moments, I've noticed films do it a lot now. It's just like, these are like video game moments in movies where it's like, oh, you know, stormtroopers are easy to beat, so now we have to give you a harder boss that has better aim.
Well, it seemed like they were almost trying to do that in Rise of Skywalker with like the Sith troopers.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know, that felt
who
to me
were
just like a toy move. They're like, we got.
It did feel
to
like I'm right, but it's like, yeah, you know, it's oh, these guys are stormtroopers, but they're red and they have more detail. They must be better. And it's like, but we didn't see that.
They're called
movie,
Sith troopers, but we don't really understand why.
They use Sith magic to clone.
Are they Sith? No. Do they fight Sith? No. Why are they Sith troopers?
Do they use Sith weaponry? No.
Are they surrounded by Sith? Uh-uh.
We're going to find that out when Chris Terrio does an interview in 30 years from now, and he just mentions it in a side thing where, you know, that becomes part of canon because now interviews are canon.
They're taking the J.K. Rowling approach where they just tweet out a change.
Yeah, exactly. Which actually is kind of what Star Wars has been doing, as they tried to make up
it
for what
J.K.
did.
It does feel like that's exactly what they've been doing.
But that's in the story of Star Wars, though, changing it after the fact.
That's true.
That is how Star Wars works.
So as the brute troopers make their way into the battle, eventually one has gotten the drop on Finn. grabs a blaster, puts a heavy foot on his chest, is about to aim for his heart, says last words, FN2187, and suddenly he's taken out by laser fire. Finn looks up, a unit of stormtroopers are coming his way, and the leader takes off his helmet, extends his hand. It's RK-514, we met just, 20 pages ago in the script?
Yep.
Lifts his, lifts Finn to his feet, hands him a blaster. He says, Rafe, and Finn says, I like it. And you know what? We didn't have a lot of time for this to happen, but I still love it.
I think they should have named him Rick.
It does feel like it should have been RF-127 or whatever it is.
Rafe.
Just because like that would follow on like, almost, the Finn Rafe. But
I almost wish he would have said like what? And he goes, Rafe. And he's like, what are you saying? What does that mean? He's like, Rafe. What? Rake? No, Rafe. Rafe.
It'd be funny if it was a name like if he was like Steven.
Steven.
Just hearing someone say Steven in Star Wars would be really funny to me.
Or if he said like, or if he was like Luke.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, he's like, your name is Luke Skywalker. Wait, what?
Oh, you can't take that one.
In movies,
man.
There's never like two Johns.
Yeah, exactly.
But in life, there's always two.
There's just so many.
At least
there can only be two. No, I think like this is Mike. I'll say you mentioned we didn't have a lot of time for it to pay off, but I think you know the counter argument to that is we had three films for this to pay off.
Yeah.
And
also 20 minutes in movie time.
I think with the way this movie continues Finn's growth, it does actually feel like he has a full arc between Force Awakens, Last Jedi, and Duel of the Fates. And so this pays off in like a big way in which when he's introduced in Rise of Skywalker and feels just like a completely unrelated character to the one we've seen in the last two films, the whole thing with Janna doesn't pay off at all. Like he's charismatic as an actor, but it doesn't mean anything. Whereas like this, I think actually does. It's the way we met him, you know?
Well, and to see him inspiring other stormtroopers, and the line that's in the script that we would have obviously visually represented is the other stormtroopers take off their helmets and throw them aside, diverse faces with a new purpose. And that's the way to conclude Finn's arc. I mean, that's what he brings following his desertion from the First Order to have him get to this point. I mean, that's what would have been the bigger emotional payoff and felt like everything, as you said, Sam, led to this point for him, and it's like, oh, okay, that's great writing.
Right. And Mike, you missed the underlined word there, freedom.
Oh, I did miss that.
Here's the thing, and I'm not even saying this to dismiss any skill or what you said, Mike. It's not even great writing. It's just competent writing.
Well, that's true. In the face of The Rise of Skywalker, it feels great, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's just like, these are the rules of writing for like this kind of story, and they followed them.
Good on Poe and Finn for coming up with names on the fly like that.
Well, Finn didn't come up with a name here. Rafe named himself.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's good on Rafe.
I wish I could name myself. My name would be Striper Vortex.
I think my name would be Rake, R-A-K-E.
Sam?
Luke. Skywalker.
I'm going to go with MT7184.
Beautiful.
So as we move on from here, we kind of get a little bit more of Leia. I don't know that Leia has as much to do in the back half of this as we would have expected, but it's still this moment where Poe is convincing Leia to go and help with the battle on Coruscant. She's a little reticent because she doesn't feel like they have the forces to help as Finn has an army. So Leia and Poe kind of have the culmination of their relationship where Poe becomes the leader. And he kind of says in this one, you know, the rebels fought that for the Empire and won, or fought the Empire and won. You showed us it could be done, but that was your war. This one's ours. Let us fight it. And it feels like a larger conversation to be had.
It's kind of the okay boomer moment.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think I would have loved if Leia was like, I just went and saw Lando, and then Poe was like, what's the Lando system?
I do think there's like a little bit in this script that, again, this is where I don't love entirely what they do with Poe. You know, I don't love the love story. I feel like he gets, again, he's kind of made into this you know, person who has, you know, smuggler connections or something, kind of like what they did in Rise of Skywalker. And I do feel like what we saw at the end of The Last Jedi was like Poe's realization that like being a hero isn't always like charging in and leading the fight. Like sometimes it's knowing when to retreat, it's knowing how to manage your resources and like save, you know, save who you have. So I would have liked if this, I love that line, like I think Oscar Isaac could deliver that, you know, it's like, this is our war, let us fight it type. Like, that's a great rousing line, but I would have liked to see in this script more of some of that tension of like, we've been running, I've done it your way, you know, we've preserved, like, what have we been saving ourselves for if not this moment? Like, now's the moment, Leia. Like, we have to take that shot again. And it's like, I think even the people who didn't like Poe's arc in The Last Jedi would maybe appreciate the way it's like, you know, he has his moment to come back and do it again. You know, he was foolhardy in, you know, rushing the whatever class, destroyer class, you know,
a dreadnought. Ship.
The dreadnought class destroyer, you know, in The Last Jedi. And now it's like, well, I know this move looks on paper as foolhardy, but like we've saved up our resources and our men and we've stoked the fires for this. This is the chance. Like that feels like it would have been a cool arc that I don't think this version of the script has. I wonder if they would have gone there or not. But I think that would have been cool.
Yeah, I think you're right that it doesn't quite pay that off as well as it could have. It sort of just winks at it rather than like fully engaging in it. But there's also, you know, I think they limited what they could do because they tried to focus on other areas of different characters, and it kind of feels like he got a bit shortchanged here. So as we go forward from here, we're now back to Mortis. Kylo making his way to the sealed stone door, and this is finally what's been building throughout the entire film. Rey and Kylo meet again, and to me, this felt so right that they wouldn't be together until their final battle. You know, and obviously they have the Force connection, they have the ability to speak through the Force like they did in The Last Jedi, but it feels like this is similar to The Force Awakens, where the first time they met, neither one of them had the mastery, or obviously Kylo had more skill than Rey did, but there was a little bit of a recklessness to the way that they fought. There was something wholly new about that, and for them to now come back and be cyclical, ending the trilogy on them having one similar final battle, mm-hmm. felt appropriate rather than it happening in the middle of the story. For the two of them to be fighting at the end as the climactic moment just felt very Star Wars. It felt like, okay, we've gotten this, we've seen it before, but now we see it as they're more powerful, they're more competent, they're more weathered, they're more experienced, and now we see them at the height of their powers having what is another battle to a higher degree, which, yes, is kind of straightforward action filmmaking where you know, you show it again and you make it, you up it and you give it a little bit more that's mm-hmm. going to wow audiences. But I felt like this felt more like Star Wars than what we saw in The Rise of Skywalker in terms of the way it was structured, to have them face in the final act and have them end that way rather than kind of way we saw it where they do come together. And it's great that they come together in The Rise of Skywalker. It's great that he's Ben again. But I prefer this. I prefer the way this plays out.
I think The Last Jedi did a good thing when it kind of paralleled Return of the Jedi a little bit, when Rey kind of like volunteers herself to go to Ren, where it's like she is naive at that point and doesn't quite know like the impending doom. And so when Luke goes to Vader, it's a very similar thing where he's like, well, I can fix this, don't worry. So you need that like first run, and then you're like, well, it was so easy for her to do that relatively as logistically. And now it's like, well, how am I ever going to meet this person again and try to explain? Cause there's such high tensions now. And so to get them back together for like a final battle, it's like, it's arduous to get there. It's hard for them to meet up again without having this battle. So it's like, when it does happen, the payoff is so great.
They also never have had, I mean, so in The Last Jedi, they fight together and then they kind of, they split the lightsaber, but in The Force Awakens, they fight, but neither of them are kind of evolved. So like Mike said, this is kind of like them at their full kind of character arc meeting up. I also, I'm conflicted because I would have liked to see a more redemptive arc for Ben.
So I that's my biggest disappointment
like,
with this
It's my biggest
script.
Qualm with this story, which is that that's what I, in a world where it's between this and The Rise of Skywalker, I think this is better and more well executed and just, I would prefer it in every way, but I, just in terms of what I wanted for that character, I would have liked to have seen a redemption, a more, you know, like he has like a moment, but like a more definitive redemption for him. Or I have always said that I want it to be kind of like a, his ending to be kind of like Frodo at the end of Return of the King, spoiler alert. Not that Frodo was a bad guy, but this idea of like, he has this redemption, but he's like, I've seen and done too much. And then he kind of goes off and lives alone.
Yeah, so this is my whenever like
he should
I think
go to Octo.
That this is I tech like this is the thought I had.
Did I take I, that from, is that a thought that I got from you? Sorry,
not necessarily. No, not necessarily. I don't think that I don't think it's necessarily like a completely like you're more than capable of arriving at the idea. But I definitely remember like when we all immediately after seeing Rise of Skywalker, we spent like. 3 weeks texting each other like our versions of the script, and one of mine was like it went differently and they ended up fighting kind of together again and they took down the First Order, but I was like at the end rather than fall in love and rather than become a fully redeemed version, he should go to Octo, and that's where the Skywalkers should end their journey, is like we have been too powerful, too great a swing, you know, for good or evil in the universe. I'm going to retreat. I will do my studies. I'll live in peace and I'll find, you know, an inner peace.
Could
alone.
You imagine
it's so
if the last shot of this like movie and like the saga was Luke's ghost and Kylo Ren standing looking at the sunset on Octo.
Oh, that's
two, you know, Jedi or, you know, whatever
and
Kylo
Anakin.
Would be. And whose fathers had failed them and were trying to find peace in that.
And then it shows him writing in a book. And it's you just see the word. You see the word saying a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And then he closes it. You know what, right? I think you brought up a good point that last with your last shot. I was just, in my mind, I'm like, if he becomes a Force ghost on the light side, then I'm like, I'm happy with that redemption, and that kind of has that Frodo-esque quality where it's like he's going to a different plane, but at least at that plane he'll
it's
be.
It's like the universe for
him. But I also think in Star Wars though, like there shouldn't be that kind of definitive ending, and there's always something to like look out. So if he is alive, then there's just like that just is like a gift as a writer to the audience where it's like, well, there's more stories here now, and so like it just kind of plants that idea in your head of like, oh, what's he doing on this island? Like, I don't know. Maybe he starts a school for the maybe he saves younglings.
He just spends his life like getting to understand the Force in a better, a more complete way.
He could Hamilton it. Maybe he like starts an orphanage and like because his grandpa killed a bunch of younglings, he's like, I'm gonna save a bunch of younglings now.
But Chris, you said is like what you set up for the fans, the fan fiction, the speculation, the next 10 years of will they make another Rey Ben movie where Rey gets Ben and brings him back from Octo?
Exactly.
I would have loved that speculation. I would have loved the fan art. I would have loved thinking about what that could be, and that it's a possibility that we could revisit these characters down the road.
A Marvel series of comics where it's like Ben in the desert alone or something when he's 60 years old.
But I think
one of the caretakers seeing him or someone seeing, you know, because there are people on Octo, there are caretakers, is saying like, what's your name? And he says, Ben. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's the same beat. It's just like the wrong character.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. Yeah. Yo, that's so true. But I would like going to Octo is him paying his penance for what he's done. Like to spend all, and you've kind of alluded to that, is to spend his time reflecting and becoming more one with the Force to continue to make up for what he did. Now, as you said, Chris, he could also then like pay that forward. But I think the time he needs to spend away, and then after he's done that, to have another story between him and Rey, it would be very powerful and very meaningful. So
also, I feel like it would have this perfect. So the end of The Force Awakens, I think, has a really great ending, and it's because it's all things at once. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hopeful. Yeah. It's also like a little haunting. There's something like haunting about it.
Yeah.
And I think with this, it's like, if that was the end of this, it'd be, you know, hopeful. He's found redemption. He's gonna. But it's, there's also something haunting. It's like he can never go back.
Right.
You know, and there's it's he dense.
Yeah.
I don't want to like say, I don't want to compliment, you know, my own idea for the last shot. It's just, I feel like all of the pieces were there for
genius.
It.
Yeah, I think it was more so than the Rise of Skywalker had a moment of that for me when the lightsabers were getting buried. I like that mystery. I love when that kind of thing happens, when it's like a tomb shuts and you're kind of like, well, who's gonna find it next? I think that's a lot of fun. But I think if you would have had this moment with an actual, like, the actual character kind of basically going in that tomb and like, well, who finds him next kind of thing, I think would have been just a blast.
So we have jumped a bit ahead because we've not talked about what actually happens between Kylo and Rey. You know, I think you can tell that Rey does come away victorious. Kylo does not win here and finish on the down note of negative evil winning.
Could he? It's Rey.
So we have another bit of a reveal, and this goes back to The Last Jedi and how things can kind of be taken and amplified and built off of playing a yes-and version of a script rather than just negating it completely. We find out that Rey has has learned through what her visions have been that her family was afraid. What were they afraid of? They were afraid of Kylo. And Rey says in the script, she says, "You still think I'd join you after what you did to my family?" And Kylo falters a bit, which is, I can see the expression on Adam Driver's face.
Oh, me too. What he does with his mouth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so with that in mind, we find out that Kylo killed her parents because they were hiding her from him, and Snoke had told him to seek out anybody who could challenge him, which to me plays back to The Force Awakens when he says, "What girl?" and then drags the officer towards him with the Force and chokes him and loses his contain. That's such a great way to pay off why he would care about the girl in the first movie.
And then it kind of also leads to like why Han knows when Maz is like,
"Yeah,
who's the girl?" Or like, "Oh, yeah." There's just like so many little nods to it. And it's also one of
so many stories that were a good story for a different time.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
But you know what? If you spend all your time on making her an actual animatronic, it's more interesting than the story you could tell about her. Different departments, they did a great job.
That's wild. I hadn't thought of it in those terms.
This is the thing, though, that so I don't know. I mean, this is part of – I don't like this bit, actually. I like what you guys are – Mike, I actually really like what you're saying in the way it, like, is a stronger kind of yes and it you know, it rewrites and redirects the story in an interesting way. But this is the thing that I don't like, and I feel like it's a screenwriting, like, movie shorthand, and it's, like, an assumption. Maybe it was once true – that it's like you have to directly connect your film's villain to the hero's pain or incompleteness.
That's
right.
Fair.
And it's like the thing they did with Tim Burton's Batman in 89. They made that in a way to quickly in their mind, you know, give shorthand to why, you know, Batman and Joker are opposite sides of the same coin. They made Joker's origin Jack Napier, who was responsible for the Wayne's deaths. They made Jack Napier the Joe Chill of that movie. And it's like, I don't know. I think it kind of works in that movie, but I also think it's one of the parts that you don't need in that movie. But this idea that it's like, oh, for Rey to really have a true catharsis, we have to, you know, and get that through Kylo, we have to have Kylo responsible for what happened to her and why she is the way she is. And it's like, I don't agree, because I don't, like, Rey has not been a vengeful character. There's such a thing, like, there, you know, it's one of the things we talked about the Marvel movies earlier that they get right with Captain America, is that it's like, he's a hero because it's the right thing to do. He's a hero because the other guy's bad, and he's just like, well, I don't want a bad person having power over good people. And so I think the idea of, like, at this point in the story, while I'm not trying to take away anything that you said that was interesting, guys, but, like, this was a thing where I was like, this feels like someone like doubting that we would believe that Rey had a reason to fight Kylo. And it's like
that's
crazy because we honestly yeah, go ahead, sorry.
That's where I fall a little bit on it too as you're saying this, because there's something that doesn't sit right with me about it, in as much as it's saying that like there's taking away of completeness of Rey, that it's like she can't have these emotions and these feelings separate from her pain that she has with her parents, which I think is kind of weakening her character a little bit and kind of not giving her the completeness that she had, that she should have, which is that she has an experience with Kylo Ren. She has all of these things that don't need to be directly connected to her parents' death or disappearance or anything. Like, that's a part of her character. It's ingrained in her, but she can have her own experiences that aren't completely informed by that.
Well, yeah, and that's what The Last Jedi did well, is that it almost said, you know, it did say very clearly, you don't need anyone else, you don't need anything else, you can be on your own, be powerful on your own.
Yeah.
And when she sees herself,
it's like,
and doesn't
that,
see her parents, yeah.
Yeah, and that could be a thing that's a part of you and tragic, but it's also like, you can also have your own experiences that make you a complete person without it.
I
to come full circle is to me a little weakening to her.
But I totally agree with what you're both saying on that. I think the thing that does play out is the way they show the darkness in her and the ferocity and the anger is tied to this in this script, and there could be better ways to do it. And so when we get to the balance at the end of this, where she's balancing the darkness and the light, we need it here, but they could have done that better, because you can show darkness and anger without it being tied to her family.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment in The Last Jedi with the when they're fighting the guards that I absolutely love, which is one of the guards like spins his weapon and Rey spins her lightsaber and lets out like a primal scream.
Yeah,
like she's just like in the moment and mad, and it works because it's like, yeah, she's been through a lot, and also she's in the middle of a fight. She's not spinning her lightsaber, and we're all thinking, do you think she thinks that guy killed her parents?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, no, she's a complete person. She has a full emotional range, and she's mad. These guys are trying to kill her.
Yeah. I mean, I think it works for me in a just kind of like a Shakespearean sense. I think it's okay. I don't think
it fully doesn't work.
For me, that kind of part of the storyline also just like was not, I don't know, if not my focus. Maybe it should have been, but I think that just goes back to the kind of like the parentage mystery thing that Star Wars is. Some people are really into that level of it, and it's something that, like, I think going into the original trilogy already knowing that reveal, I think it's kind of lost that effect on me. I think that the parent reveal, or the reveal that he killed her parents, I think kind of harkens back to what George Lucas was originally doing to everyone in the script. I think it's almost a nostalgic move to say that he killed her parents, because George Lucas originally told everyone on the set and everything that the line was like, no, I killed your parents.
Right.
And so I think it was just kind of just basically the same idea of Return of the Jedi, Revenge of the Jedi. I think they were just kind of doing a nostalgic move there of taking it. I'm sorry, my cat decided to jump on me and is licking me now profusely.
I feel that in the script? In case anyone's yelling at their computer or phone right now. George told everyone that the line was, no, he killed your parent, your father.
Yeah, Obi-Wan, yeah.
Obi-Wan,
yeah. Yeah. Said that he killed his father because he.
Oh, right. But just the idea that someone like that, you know, or whatever, killed your parents.
Yeah. A betrayal.
Yeah, but she already saw him kill her surrogate father, and then I think the bigger like letdown between Rey and Ben happened in The Last Jedi. Like when he didn't join her, and when he in fact expected her to join him, that's the biggest, deepest well, you know, that she can fall down. It was absolute heartbreak. And that works in that movie, and it would carry over into this one. So again, like we don't need to belabor it, but like,
yeah, that's fair.
They're over seasoning the dish. Yeah, it's like, I don't understand. Why is Kylo so bad? Like, we get it.
but they do call back to that, Sam. I mean, there is the reaching out of the hand and saying please, except this time it's from Rey to Kylo. It's just that they also add this before which is not as interesting as exploring her conflicted feelings for him, the conflicted meaning and belonging that they both are seeking that would have been more interesting to explore. I think one of the reasons why I initially was like, this is great, is because it didn't completely dismiss what I loved before, that she was no one. Like, it didn't take that and ruin that. And so I was like, okay, well, this is better.
I'm with you on that, Mike. I think that would have been my main concern. I had no problems if they explored the parentage further, but I think as long as it was along the same lines of what we got from The Last Jedi. But I think to your point, when you're saying when she reaches out, I think one of, like, just as a message and like an act of just kind of like Jedi evenness is, like, if you're reaching out to the person that you now know killed your parents, like, that's powerful. Like, that's a lot. Like, that's like, Batman's not shaking hands with the Joker.
No, he hits him right after he puts his glasses on.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they're doing it. That to me is kind of like what the saving grace of that scene would be, and kind of what takes that vengeance element away. Like, she can be angry and she has to beat him, but like the fact that she's given an opportunity to say, hey, like, we could do this.
It's an interesting, I mean, look, I appreciate it, and I appreciate that you like it. It's a good read, Chris, I think. Because we didn't actually talk about it. So they have been fighting. She has been, like, blinded.
No, we haven't gotten to that point.
Yeah, at the
No, we only we only talked, yeah. we haven't, there's this cut back, though, because if we're going along the script, it's where she finds out, she says, you know, you killed my family, and then they're like, flash to, we see the flashback, and then it's
I'm
like, I know, and they're about to
the
battle.
Reaching, I'm saying if we're talking about the reaching out moment.
Oh,
which is what,
okay, sorry. Yeah, I just figured we jumped a bit ahead, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like we were talking about it without context. So, like, we can get to it, I guess.
Well,
if you're not understanding what Chris is talking about, we'll get to it soon.
I think, well, it was just a brief mention that there's a mirroring of this scene from The Last Jedi, except Rey does it this time, and we're going to get to that. But we have clearly reached the point where we are doing a part five. I think that's clear to everyone.
Part four, part two.
Part four, part two, yes, of seven.
My cat wants this. She's like, please stop talking about this movie.
But if we want, we can continue and finish the story here of Rey and Kylo, and the battle that they have, because, and then go back and talk more about Coruscant, whichever way we would prefer to go.
Oh, I'll let you. You should continue to lead, Mike. You've been doing great. I didn't mean to. I was just thinking about what we were talking about. Didn't have the full picture painted. So you go for it. Where do you want to go?
Dealer's choice.
I say, well, we've talked about the thematic stuff, so why don't we'll end part IV, part one here, and then we'll follow up with the completion of the plot and the other characters' arcs.
All right, I think that's
part,
fair. I mean,
part
I will...
IV part two.
There you go, guys. That's how it gets made. Now you know how podcasts
there
get
you
made.
Go. You got a peek behind the sausage right there. A peek behind the sausage.
I do want to say I had one note that I had written down that if Rey knew about what Kylo had done, you know, if she knew when she was a kid what had happened to her parents, then she's basically Space Batman. Or Space Bat 1, right?
Spaceman.
I like that.
Space Bat.
Space Bat, I like.
Space Bat. Well, then we will continue onward in Duel of the Fates, Part 4.2. This never ends. Sam, how you feeling? How you feeling about where we're at? We've still got probably another, 35 pages of the script?
Sam's
I feel great.
So mad.
This is exact. Look, guys, what I didn't tell you is this is, so far, this is all going exactly to my plan. We'll get there someday. Here's the thing that matters to our listeners.
Yeah.
We're putting out great conversations. We're putting out great content. We're painting for them. We're imagineering and painting a movie in their brains. And that I think should take, you know, as long as any movie, which is 7 or 8 hours over the course of multitudes of weeks.
Sam, if I win the painting contest, I want you to paint a scene for me from the Duel of the Fates.
Oh, boy. Yikes. Okay. Well, that's a fun challenge.
I like that.
If you win, Mike, maybe I'll do that.
Well, considering I'm choosing the winner, I think I got this one in the bag.
I want you to paint the scene in Duel of the Fates where Leia and Luke kiss and Han walks in.
And Lando's there, too. You know what? This is there.
I don't know what he's up to.
This is it, though. You know, it's like this is one of the last Skywalker saga nuggets that we have left, too. So why not savor it? Enjoy it. We always equate this stuff to some fine meals. So let this be the... I don't know what's something that lasts long when you're eating.
I mean, you could do what I do to nuggets and eat it whole.
this is the 50 piece chicken nugget
swallowing them like a pill.
you stop for a while. You're like, can I do it? Can I get through this? And you have about 10 more, and you're like, all right, there's a little room left. I can do this.
And then you get added another 10 more after that, and then it's another 10 more after that because
exactly. And you're like, let's go to the drive-thru again.
Well, that is going to do it for this edition of the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Don't forget, April 18th, 7 p.m. Eastern, we are going live on live.droidspod.com. You can watch us there. Join us for, of course, the original film, 1977 Star Wars. And be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Email us, droidspod@gmail.com. Twitter.com/droidspod. Instagram, droidspod. Facebook, the Droids Podcast. You can find the live there as well. And be sure to enter those reviews in to get a chance to win a custom Sam painting for whatever scene you can dream up from the Duel of the Fates. Maybe you're just going to do your own fan fiction, and Sam will draw that for you, do a little painting of that for you. I think we get it all out there, right?
I want a picture of Luke kissing Claude.
Well, that will do it for the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. What they throw?
Annie? Do you have any moof milk?
I have moofs, Greg. Can you milk me?